Hello and welcome to another episode of Radio War Nerd. The date today is December 17th, 2025, and this is episode 568. I am the co-host, Mark Ames, in Western New York. You are listening to Radio War Nerd. That means you should, if you haven't already, subscribe to Radio War Nerd. That is in order. Go to patreon.com/Radio War Nerd. And speaking of orders, get John Dolan's new book, the new War Nerd book on the U.S. Civil War. They should have been hanged. The War Nerd essays on the U.S. Civil War. Review it, know it, live it. Yeah, so we're going to have a great interview today with our guest, Miguel Tinker Salas. I actually wanted to have him on last week, last Friday. This being Radio War Nerd, I guess we're going to have to talk about illnesses because that is the ongoing subset theme for now over 10 years. Yeah, I made a great move. I was hungry. I was at the local Wegmans. I saw a salmon poke bowl that was just screaming my name. Brought it home because I was starving my ass off. I don't have time. Started eating it, and dang if it didn't smell a little funny. And I thought to myself, no way would Wegmans, these wonderful neighborhood, grocery store, would they sell me a bad salmon poke bowl? And I cannot say with 100% certainty that it was that salmon poke bowl, but I just remember thinking it smelled and tasted a little funny. But being stupid, I continued eating it to every last bite, every last drop. And I'll just say this, it's now been a week since I ate it, actually a week to the day. I somehow made it through last week's recording with Anibale on Operation Barbarossa. I almost canceled it beforehand because I wasn't sure if I was going to be vomiting during it, but I didn't. But I did have to cancel on Miguel Salas on Friday. To quote Leonard in Full Metal Jacket, I was in a world of shit. And it really, it was extremely unpleasant. I do wish salmonella on my worst enemies, but nobody else. It was hell. And I'm still kind of dealing with it. I actually dragged myself to my pediatrician or to the nurse anyway and tried to get antibiotics because I'm a big believer in antibiotics. And there's this whole funny theory going around now. One of them is don't give them real painkillers when they're in pain because they might feel too good. And the other one is don't give them antibiotics when they're vomiting and diarrheaing their brains out because the gut health or some such. So I'm supposed to go through this the natural way, like a natural birth of salmonella bacteria colonies. But anyway, I'm better enough today. I'm sorry to our guest, Miguel, that this happens to be the intro, but, you know, we're all human, and this is Radio War Nerd. And that's all I have to say about that. So let's get right to our interview with our guest, Miguel Tinker Salas. Okay, we are very honored to have with us our guest today, Miguel Tinker Salas. He is Emeritus Professor of History and Chicana Latina Studies at Pomona College. He's also the author of several books on Latin America, politics, Venezuela. One book in particular that I want to discuss today, a great book that I just read, actually on friend of the show, Greg Grandin's suggestion, which is Venezuela, What Everyone Needs to Know. And it is a great, concise history of Venezuela that, you know, of course it is concise, but really opens your eyes and gives you a sense of their own internal dynamics and politics, unlike anything else I've seen. So first of all, Miguel, thank you for coming on Radio War Nerd.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure, and thanks for your audience.
So I think, first of all, well, obviously one of the reasons we have you on the show is because Venezuela is front center in the eyesight or the, you know, target range for the Trump administration. This was something that they were, I'd kind of forgotten about it because so much happened between 2020 and 2025. How much Trump and Rubio, when he was a senator, were targeting Venezuela for regime change. But this time it's gone much bigger. And so before we get into Venezuelan history, which I'm going to want to discuss with you in your excellent book, I think we should just start with what's going on today. And if you don't mind, I'd like to read to you Trump's latest outrageous tweet. And I'm just going to read this in case people haven't seen it or heard it yet. Venezuela is completely surrounded by the large... This is Trump, not me. Venezuela is completely surrounded by the largest armada ever assembled in the history of South America. It will only get bigger and the shock to them will be like nothing they have ever seen before until such time as they return to the United States of America all of the capital oil, land, and other assets that they previously stole from us. The illegitimate Maduro regime is using oil from these stolen oil fields to finance themselves, drug terrorism, human trafficking, murder, and kidnapping. For the theft of our assets and many other reasons, including terrorism, drug smuggling, and human trafficking, has been designated a foreign terrorist organization, the Maduro regime. Therefore, today, I am ordering, all caps, a total and complete blockade of all sanctioned oil tankers going into and out of Venezuela. The illegal aliens and criminals that the Maduro regime has sent into the United States during the weekend and blah, 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 blah. Anyway, what he has announced is a full naval blockade of Venezuela. And, you know, having, Miguel, having written about, studied, researched, lived this ongoing story between America and Latin America and Venezuela in particular, What do you make of this?
Well, at first, I was flabbergasted. I mean, it was maddening coming from Donald Trump. Not surprising, though. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, I wanted to be the scholar and say, in 1976, Venezuela nationalized oil. It was fully compensated, so yes. American corporations received all their assets paid for in full. And in fact, they had already recouped their investment from all the oil they had extracted from Venezuela. So it was in 76 and it was compensated. So from a historical point of view, he's simply completely wrong. But then again, Stephen Miller had texted the same thing, calling it the largest robbery, largest ripoff of U.S. Resources abroad. So we can see where the line of thinking is going here, right? Mm-hmm. We have, as you pointed out early on, you have Trump, then you have Stephen Miller, then you have Marco Rubio, then you have Hegseth, all of them operating in an environment in which they know nothing and invent things as they go along. Venezuelans' oil is Venezuelans. It reminds me of the old saying we had during the Iraq War that said, essentially, how did the U.S.'s oil get under Venezuelan soil? How did that magic trick? That magic trick occur? Yes. This is Venezuelans' oil. This is not U.S. oil. These are Venezuelan oil assets, not the U.S.'s. There is an American company operating in Venezuela. It's called Chevron. Mm-hmm. And it is rewarded handsomely by exporting oil into the U.S. And making a profit. So again, I didn't know how to react. I was torn from being the scholar to also being the political observer and thought this was in jest, except that the people who pay the price for it are the Venezuelan population, because an embargo means that Venezuela can't export its oil. Oil is the lifeblood of the economy. Oil is what allows Venezuela to import medicine, machinery, food if it needs it, medical devices, oil industry devices. Since it's to establish an embargo is to strangle the economy, but it's to strangle the population, because the assumption is somehow the population will revolt. Mm-hmm. And that has not happened. Sanctions and embargoes have not worked in any country, not Iran, not Cuba, not Haiti, not any other country where they've been applied.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just a quote here, a tweet from Francisco Rodriguez. In practice, this decision amounts to a full naval blockade of Venezuela. Cutting off all oil revenue will lead to a massive reduction in food imports and is likely to trigger the first major famine in the Western Hemisphere in modern history. And also, I would imagine, another wave of migrants as well.
Well, yeah, this is the irony. I mean, Trump wants to, he's talking about in the document or in the tweet he sent out on Truth Social, he's talking about take back all your prisoners and mental cases, et cetera, et cetera. That's part of the narrative the opposition has sold him on,
right,
to believe that everyone coming has been sent by the Maduro government, that it's all being orchestrated by supposed gangs, the Tren de Aragua, another cartel, this cartel, that cartel, but it's all part of a machination. It's not true. People who left Venezuela left because the economic situation got so dire, because sanctions have been applied. 7 to 8 million people left their country, not because Maduro sent them, but because the economic crisis and because of U.S. sanctions.
The sanctions were meant to destabilize the regime and society, to destabilize society in order to undercut support for Maduro's government. And they did destabilize society. I mean, they did hurt, right? So, but they didn't undercut. I mean, I don't know. Would you say they undercut support for Maduro? Like, what? How has it affected the internal
politics? I think it has undercut support for Maduro. But there's also a flip side to that, is that the majority of the population is against the U.S. intervention.
Right.
They're against U.S. sanctions. So that it puts the opposition in a rather interesting position, because if they support the sanctions, which they do, if they support an intervention, which they have said they do, then they are pitted against the interests of the Venezuelan population at large. And there's the contradiction, that the policies that they pursue are increasing the pain and the suffering for the population they claim to represent. So again, it puts them in a contradictory position. But again, the key issue here is that the narrative we see coming from Trump is a narrative that has been created, fashioned by the opposition to tap into what they think Trump will respond to: narco-terrorism. Well, there is no fentanyl coming from Venezuela. The U.S. military acknowledges that. The U.S. intelligence acknowledges that. Only 7% of the cocaine is trafficked through Venezuela. The majority, over 90%, is trafficked through Colombia, Ecuador, Peru, and on the Pacific coast, not the Caribbean, so that narrative doesn't play. So now we're there. Maria Corina Machado, the leader of the opposition, talked about how the country has been invaded by Russians and that the oil was going to supply Hamas and Hezbollah.
Right.
Again, that's part of the narrative that they expect that will play in a U.S. audience and will play for Donald Trump.
Yeah. Here is, do you know who Francisco Paleo is, opposition supporter?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. His response to your point, quick clarification, his response to Trump's announcement, because words matter, even if POTUS sometimes forget it. The United States has zero claim to Venezuelan territory, no treaty, no legal doctrine, no court ruling, nothing. When Trump talks about oil, land, and assets, the only part grounded in reality is oil and financial assets expropriated by the Chavez Maduro regime. Land is rhetorical shorthand, not a literal territorial claim. This is sloppy language that creates confusion, not an announcement of annexation. So they really are on their back feet here, because they both have to show that they oppose it, but they also don't want to upset their sponsor, the Trump regime.
Right.
So they're saying what he meant to say. They're like, you know, Trump-splaining.
Well, if you want a Trump-splain, be my guest, because you are going to be doing this for 24/7.
Yeah.
It's like opposition videos that I've seen that say, don't call it regime change, call it democracy promotion. Don't call it this, that, or the other. They want to fashion the language, because by fashioning the language, they create the narrative and they create public opinion. I'm not here to support Maduro. I am not a Maduro supporter, but I am against any U.S. intervention in any foreign country, because the larger issue here is not just Venezuela. Venezuela is in the crosshairs right now.
Yes.
The larger issue is the same way the neocons wanted to remake the Middle East.
Yes.
These new cons want to remake Latin America. Venezuela is today, tomorrow it's Cuba, the next day is what, is Nicaragua, and after that the pressure is on Mexico and Brazil. That's the world that they envision. That's the world that Marco Rubio envisions. That's the playbook that they're engaged in right now.
Right. Yeah, it's wild. I mean, it seems so retrograde. But, you know, one thing is they can't really, it's hard for the opposition to try to do sort of liberal message discipline because you're dealing with the Trump regime, which very explicitly, ideologically opposes that kind of soft power messaging as antithetical to their values and to the way they see the world. They want to lay it out as it really is. We are here to take your oil and you are to, you know, to bow to me. Like that's
the and I have been arguing that it's not just about oil. I've been arguing just the opposite. Mm-hmm. And here Trump proves me wrong. Trump says it's about oil. So I've been trying to make a more complex scenario because I think it's about Latin America.
I think you're right. Yeah.
I think it's about how they envision Latin America, particularly in the context of the new strategic security plan that came out about 10 days ago, in which they talk about the Western Hemisphere being their backyard, which they talk about that resource assets only belong to the U.S. That's not me. That's the Trump administration saying that resource allocation, that they will object to any foreign power acquiring resources in Latin America. So they're envisioning it back as the old, not so much the Monroe Doctrine, but the Roosevelt corollary to the Monroe Doctrine, which allows the U.S. to intervene in any country in Latin America as it sees fit. And again, that involved Venezuela in 1989, 1902, 1904, around the issue of the British and the claims for debts, and Roosevelt ensuingly declaring the Roosevelt corollary.
Right. So, again, just sticking with the contemporary stuff before we go back in history, and we'll talk about that as well. I'm just curious what you could tell us about Maria Corina Machado, the strangely winner of the Nobel Peace Prize. I guess you could say Henry Kissinger and stuff, but it's strange that civilians usually are just very peace and love, you know, for the most part. And then sometimes they give the Nobel to leaders who may have, you know, ended a war or something, but they're
FIFA will give it to anybody as long as they support it. yes. As we saw with
that's
the case of
Donald
Trump.
Nobel. That's the real Nobel,
which is about making Donald Trump happy and giving him a peace prize.
Right. But what can you tell us about Maria Corina Machado? Does she have as much support in the country as she does in the halls of power in the West?
Undoubtedly, she won the primary that the opposition had. Approximately 2.4 million people voted. She won the lion's share of that vote.
This was which year?
This was before the election, which the election was 2024. Mm-hmm. We're talking 2022, 2023, in which there was an election within the opposition.
Right.
I think it's important to point out that she's the opposition's principal spokesperson, but she's not the only opposition leader.
Yes.
There is an opposition in Venezuela that is very active, that is against the intervention and is against Maduro.
Right.
And they don't find that to be contradictory. You can defend your own country's sovereignty and integrity, and you can still be against the government. And that's the case that many in the opposition find themselves in Venezuela. Maria Corina Machado is the daughter of elites in Venezuela. She has her father was worked for an oil for a steel company, Sivensa. She became involved in politics early on. She created the organization called Sumate, which means add on, join us, which received money, according to most studies, from the National Endowment for Democracy. One would be at protest in Venezuela and always be amazed at how they had the microphone, they had the system. They also received funding from USFALD, which is the AFL-CIO.
Those guys, man, they've been around in Latin America a long time.
They've been around a long time. Jay Lovestone, former communist, was the director of Latin American Affairs for the AFL-CIO, 50s and 60s.
We did an episode on what they did in Guyana to the president there, or the leader of the left there. It's just a brutal story. Yeah.
She signed her name on the Carmona list for the coup in 2002. She was an active participant in the recall election of 2004. She formed Vente Venezuela, her at that time political party, in 2011, 2014. She served in the Venezuelan National Assembly. She participated actively as with Leopoldo López and Ledesma as part of the leadership of La Salida in 2014, the exit, which was an attempt at insurrection in which parts of cities in Caracas and the interior were taken over by the opposition and held. She participated in the Guarimba in 2017, which was another effort at insurrection against the government. They insist that every election in Venezuela was illegitimate, that Chavez never won in 1998, that he never won in 2000, that he never won, et cetera, et cetera. That's part of the narrative they've created to say that the past under Chavez and then subsequently Maduro has been illegitimate, does not reflect Venezuela, when in fact it does reflect Venezuela. We can get into that in particular. She supported sanctions against Venezuela. She supported the maximum pressure campaign of Trump in the first administration with the interim president, Juan Guaido. Today, she pulls back from that because Guaido is enmeshed in corruption charges, et cetera. She supported sanctions. She has been an outspoken supporter of Israel and the effects of Netanyahu's campaign of genocide in Gaza. And she says she would move the capital from to the capital in Israel.
Oh, the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem.
Jerusalem. And she is a supporter, has said that Venezuela will open up immediately to neoliberal economic reforms, privatize the oil company, and has presented a program that in many ways it would be a return back to the past. And doesn't really offer a clear solution. The term libertad, liberty, everyone supports liberty, but what comes after that process and after that term is expired? What is the economic plan? What is the social plan? What is the economic plan? And how do you deal with a country that now will face significant hardship, poverty, inequality? And the Maduro government has done a horrible job on that.
Yeah, well, let's talk about Maduro. I mean, I guess to talk about Maduro, you have to talk about Hugo Chavez and his election victory. And then, I mean, God, then you want to go back to like Caracas or whatever, you know, but let's not do that. Let's try and focus more on Maduro, who came to power when he was a vice president, who came to power when Hugo Chavez died, sort of untimely death from cancer in 2013. How would you describe the differences? What's different about him? We did an episode some years ago with an Argentinian economist who's a supporter of Chavez and sort of like you, not a fan of Maduro. He just thought Maduro was a terrible manager of finance and economics, leaving aside other stuff. But what was different about Maduro from the start, and why did Hugo Chavez, how did he rise up to the top?
Well, Hugo Chavez is a reflection of the contradictions that are evident in Venezuelan society in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. The assumption was that Venezuela achieves a democracy in 1958. It's interesting to highlight that Venezuela, it's most of the 20th century, since 1898 forward until 1958, had been ruled by military strongmen. These were generals, all of them from one state, from the state of Táchira, on the Colombian border. They gave, the first of which was Cipriano Castro. Then it was Juan Vicente Gómez, Eleazar López Contreras, Medina Angarita. So you have a series of generals. And you have, in the process, you have a gradual opening of the political process. Political parties begin to play an important role in the 1930s and 40s.
To interrupt you, but because they all came from this Andean state on the far west border with Colombia. Was there antagonism, I imagine, between them? Because Caracas is in the north center, sort of the country.
That's right. It's the north center. There was antagonism. These were people raised in a coffee export producing economy, a land-based export economy, so that they objected to the discord that was occurring elsewhere in Venezuela. Right. There's a marvelous book written called Los Andinos en el Poder by Domingo I'm getting a name confused right now. Andinos in the Power, Andean People in Power. Mm. And it documents the nature of that international economy, trade between Táchira and Colombia, German exporters who bought the coffee and placed it on markets, the role of Maracaibo in the agricultural economy and its relationship to Europe and Germany abroad. Maracaibo that would become the center of the oil industry after 1920. Mm-hmm. So that those are all important factors to keep in mind. Right. So oil is discovered in Venezuela in 1914 in Mene Grande, and then subsequently in La Rosa in the 1920s. One of the largest wells ever producing in Venezuela in the world, 100,000 barrels a day. Mm. And the country enters the oil export economy and becomes one of the leading world producers of oil by the 1930s, and a net importer of food as mm-hmm. well. So that goes hand in hand with becoming yeah. the leading exporter of oil, because people abandoned the countryside, which was difficult economically, politically, and health-wise. Yeah. Population was relatively small at that time. So in that context, oil becomes the engine of the economy. Oil begins to transform Venezuela, but not everywhere. So this is uneven development. So here's Chavez out of the state of Barinas, an agricultural entity. His parents are teachers. They're relatively not well off. Mm-hmm. And like many in his generation, he sees the military as a vehicle for transformation or change right. and for social climbing. The Venezuelan military is interesting in that it's not your oligarchical military. There mm-hmm. was an opening in that military for a lot of people who were of lower socioeconomic status to utilize the military as a method of social climbing, to receive an education, to go to college, to become more than what they could have been if they remained in their agricultural towns.
When did that when did the military take on that sort of a possibility for people? Was it always like that, or was that a 20th century thing?
It's a 20th century. It's 20th okay. century. Because the military, previous to that, you had an elite officer corps, but a rank and file that was mostly drawn in from the lower working classes and campesinos and peasantry, et cetera, and mm-hmm. others. So in that sense, it was a much different kind of military. But right. after 58, this military begins to change.
I see.
And that military, in many ways, opens spaces so that Hugo Chavez can use that. And the military also allowed its cadets to go and take classes at the university. Mm-hmm. So you can imagine someone like a Chavez sitting at a class in the UCV in Caracas, taking classes and listening about imperialism and capitalism mm-hmm. and nationalism and all the social movements that were occurring in that time. And a generation that increasingly became nationalist and was concerned about the discrepancy in wealth that was occurring in Venezuelan society. And let me just underscore here that after 58, Venezuela became known as the model democracy for the U.S. in Latin America, mm-hmm. especially vis-a-vis Cuba. So Venezuela right. had its democratic revolution in 58. Cuba had it in January of 59, and they became polar opposites. Right. The Venezuelan leader, Romulo Betancourt, disliked intensely Fidel Castro, and Fidel Castro was no fan of Romulo Betancourt either. Even though when Fidel Castro comes to power, the first country he visits is Venezuela. And he has massive rallies in downtown Caracas and is received at the university. And Betancourt actually meets him, but they are not on the same level.
Betancourt is very anti-communist, like an anti-communist leftist, anti-communist liberal sort of.
Anti-communist liberal. Yeah. With Acción Democrática, Venezuela made anti-communism the cornerstone of its foreign policy. Mm-hmm. That's the best way of putting it.
Is that for domestic reasons or to keep the U.S. off his back? Or both.
Both. Okay. Both. Because the Communist Party was influential, but never large.
Right.
The interesting part is that they actually, they're like a middleweight boxer who's hitting at the full weight size.
Right.
Because they had intellectuals, they had people in positions of influence, but the party was relatively small. In election after election, it never got more than 5-6% of the popular vote. So in that sense, it's difficult to say that they were a dramatic political force, mm-hmm. but for international reasons, but for particularly the role of Cuba, so that Venezuela became a good counterweight
right.
To Cuba as a model John Foster Dulles talks about it being a model even before 60-61. Others talk about it in the same context. And in that sense, Hugo Chavez is witnessing these transformation, these changes. But so is the U.S. In 1974, when I was doing, I found a document dated from 1974 from the National Security Council that called Venezuela a nouveau riche country that has moved from the burro to the car to the jet overnight. And if there is not dramatic social change, the country could erupt. And another Castro-like figure could emerge. So the U.S. keenly understood the contradictions in Venezuela and yet promoted the country as this model democracy, even though you had high inequality. You might have the Concorde jet landing in Maiquetía, the airport, but you had people in ranchos lining the airport area. And that's the discrepancy, and that's the contradiction between the image of the country as a model democracy, wealthy, and that's where you have to draw the parallel when people say, we want to go back to the past. Which past do you want to go back to? The one of inequality, the one where poverty was so dominant, the one that, of course, you had the sector of society that could be on a plane on Friday, be in Miami, spend the weekend in Miami, back to work on Monday. But that was a minority of the population. That was not a significant part of the population. And that's the contradiction that confronts someone like an Hugo Chavez or confronts anybody of his generation who wanted social change.
Right. Well, my understanding is that the poor and, let's say, darker skin, browner, black, Afro, were very alienated from this model democracy. Until Hugo Chavez really politicized them, really went in and democratized and politicized them, went into, you know, the barrios, went into the slums, went everywhere, and sort of brought them into the process, which was one of the pillars of Chavismo. Is that correct?
Yes and no. There was an ample class of people who were Afro Venezuelans or indigenous Venezuelans who acquired wealth and status. You had a part of the elite structure. It was very interesting in Venezuela. The notion of miscegenation, the notion of racial mixing, is referred to as café con leche, coffee and milk. The real challenge was how much milk was in that coffee, because the question wasn't you could people had African heritage. They actually talked about having African heritage, but immediately they operated within a white dominant aesthetic. That privileged whiteness, that privileged Western-style beauty, and that's the Miss Venezuela pageant and the Miss Venezuela contest. And Venezuela was known because it won 6 Miss Universes. But the reality was that there was a segment of the population that was mixed race, that did attain some status, a minority, but still, nonetheless, the system had some space for it, although the majority of people who were poor tended to be people of color, of Afro-Venezuela, of indigenous Venezuela, and of mixtures thereof. Also, keep in mind, there's a large immigrant population in Venezuela, too, a large Italian, Portuguese, Spanish, Syrian, Lebanese population in Venezuela as well.
Yeah, you go over all that again in your excellent book. So let's move up to Maduro then. So Chavez he stages a coup that fails in 1992, really on the back of how neoliberal austerity measures in the 1980s just really laid waste to society in Venezuela, eviscerated, you know, masses of people, and then destroyed. It destroyed people's faith in the two-party system. In fact, I want to read a section from your book here because I thought, you know, it comes later here, but it now rings familiar rather than as something interesting to read about in a foreign place. You talk about the Caracazo, which was the riots, the very deadly riots that broke out after the president that was elected.
Carlos Andrés Pérez.
He was much more of a developmental oriented president in the 70s. He promised to stop austerity. I mean, we've seen this so many times since the 1980s in this country and all around the world. promised to, you know, institute more social welfare programs, comes to power, and then just takes his cue right from the IMF, whatever the hardcore neoliberal austerity program is. That sets off a mass riot, which is called the Caracazo. Up to, I mean, I've read different reports between 1,000 and 3,000 people killed. Is that correct?
That's correct. And never accounted, never fully accounted for. And this is the contradiction, because here Carlos Andrés Pérez had, before being inaugurated, had traveled throughout the third world and said he was the leader of the third world. Mm-hmm. He was going to fight neoliberalism. He was going to fight against all these. And he comes into power, and among the first things he does is an austerity measure. And the trigger here is Venezuelan society was accustomed to low price for gasoline, subsidized transportation for buses. That compensated for the lack of social programs or wages, so that they were accustomed to a whole series of subsidies maintained by oil. So when those subsidies are removed, you have students protesting. They were going to travel from the cities surrounding Caracas to Caracas, and that begins a cascade. Begins with students, it begins with commuters, and then it cascades into a massive protest against these austerity measures. And the reality was, and it showed the disconnect between the power elite and the Venezuelan population, was that they never assumed that this could happen in Venezuela. Yes. That could happen somewhere else. That could happen in Argentina. That could happen somewhere else. But they were so distant from the reality of the average Venezuelan that they never thought possible that the Caracazo could happen. And they had to bring in the military forces from the interior to come and squash. And again, this goes back to what we talked about earlier, a group of military officers who were now called upon to repress their own population and who made a promise that they would never do that again. And that's an important issue. And that's what began distinguishing Chavez from other leaders in that context.
Right. I also just want to point out, because I think it is important, that the Caracazo happens roughly the same time, same year and roughly the same time, I don't know how many months apart, as the Chinese crackdown in Tiananmen Square. And which actually killed somewhere, you know, you don't want to compare, but you got to, depending on who you believe, between 300 and 1,000 people. It was awful, of course, but the Caracazo, proportionally and otherwise, was far deadlier. It was a reaction to policies specifically imposed from, written in Washington, D.C., you know, in the IMF and so on. And yet, I have to admit, I didn't even find out about it. I was researching something and reading a socialist site, and it referred to that. And it's like, it's so well buried, even though it happened just across the, across the sea from America. I find that just enraging. But I want to read what you wrote here. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, but I think that's key, what you point out. Venezuela did not actually appear on the U.S. radar. It was relegated to this model democracy. Nothing happened there. They didn't have racial contradictions. They didn't have class contradictions. They had a baseball team that was great and sent players to the U.S. They had a lot of oil. They were close allies to the U.S. They voted with the U.S. and the OAS and the U.N. Right. Few academics actually studied Venezuela, and those that did were primarily in the colonial period, not the contemporary era. And therefore, Venezuela got very little attention in the U.S. media. And that's something that persists, because the U.S. lacks the tools with which to understand Venezuelan society. And you can't rely on one segment of the population to interpret a society as complex to you. Mm-hmm.
So I'll just read again what you write about the Caracazo, because this is what neoliberalism did to the former status quo. The Caracazo, as the events became known, sent shockwaves throughout the political establishment in Venezuela and had repercussions that were felt in Washington as well. The violent protests revealed the extent to which most Venezuelans had lost faith in the parties and political institutions and instead lashed out at commercial symbols in their midst. The government's incapacity to foresee problems in the wake of their austerity measures underscores the extent to which they had lost touch with the conditions in the country. Traditional assumptions about the nature of an ordered society that had ameliorated class and racial differences and the viability of its democracy had been shaken. The dominant narrative, the product of the Punto Fijo Accords, we can talk about that, no longer held sway over significant numbers of citizens. Some observers recognized that Venezuela would never be the same. One historian lamented that he thought he had understood Venezuela, yet it took only 3 days for his understanding to come undone. I mean, I think about the kind of the mental earthquake for really our establishment in 2016 when Trump won. I'm not a fan of Trump, mind you, but it was a real shock, a massive shock. And they were already starting to understand that faith in the two parties, in the parties and in establishment institutions was, I mean, polls were showing it had declined precipitously since, I mean, particularly since the 2008, you know, crash and Obama's reaction to it. But they had an excuse. It was Russian disinformation or something that did it. But do you see any, in any sense, like these moments when, and it seems to be, there seems to be a common theme here, neoliberalism eventually breaks the status quo, even though neoliberalism is the preferred ideology of the status quo.
Like, no, I think there's parallels. I think you point out something very interesting. I think there's parallels there that you've tapped into. If we think about Donald Trump's election in 2016, would that have been possible without an Obama and his inability to actually fulfill half of the promises that he had mm-hmm. made during the multiple campaigns? And this is, again, the same thing in the context of Venezuela. Would the Caracazo have happened if the mm-hmm. party system, the two-party system, had been actually cognizant yes. and concerned about the social reality that was happening in Venezuela and the growing cultural, political, and economic chasm that mm-hmm. was fracturing the society, fracturing the country, and creating dramatic fissures. I think those are the parallels there that we can draw upon to understand that Trump didn't just appear on the stage.
Right.
The Caracazo and Chavez didn't just appear on the stage. They are the product of those very societies. Mm-hmm. And this is what many would like to discount. Oh, he's an aberration. Chavez
yes.
is an aberration.
Yes.
He's not an aberration. He is the result of the contradictions that have been fueling in Venezuela, that have been nurtured in Venezuela. Trump is not an aberration.
Mm-hmm.
He is the product of an American society that had been betrayed and had been sold liberal, neoliberal policies and economics, mm-hmm. And therefore lashed out now at immigrants and lashed mm-hmm. out at the weakest as a pretext for their own condition and their own maladies.
Yeah, exactly. So Chavez goes to the electoral process. He wins in 1998. And I feel like it takes, at least for the Americans, like a couple years to really hit them that this is something different. He kind of, like, there was such a sense of the direction of history, the kind of end of history, the Fukuyamian, like, we're all going towards one direction, and whatever Chavez says he is, it doesn't matter. It's all going in one kind of liberal direction anyway. And then, of course, by 2002, you already have, well, it started before then, but the U.S. deeply involved in a coup to overthrow him, and it's been kind of hellish ever since. But anyway, so Chavez rules from 1998 to 2013. He wins legitimately all these elections. He does lose one referendum and conceded that he lost one particular referendum. We can get into that. And then he dies. Maduro takes over. Who is Maduro, and where does he deviate from Chavez, or does he?
Well, Maduro is not Chavez. That's the main yeah. thing. That's the main lesson to take away. Chavez, in many ways, is an organic intellectual that represented the social, cultural, and political reality of Venezuela. Born in the interior, in the countryside. Maduro is the product of an urban society. He's a child of the 60s, born in 1962. He played baseball. He was on a rock and roll band. He played guitar, bass guitar. He became a student organizer, then a labor organizer. He joined the bus drivers union and became the leader of the bus drivers and metro union in Caracas. He quickly saw the importance of Chavez. And after Chavez was arrested for the coup, him and his wife Celia Flores became part of the group that tried to get Chavez out of jail, and then were original members of the movement that Chavez, the Bolivarian movement that Chavez organized after he was released. They also were part of the Constituent Assembly that was involved in helping rewrite the Constitution, he was a member of the assembly, and subsequently became positions within the Chavez government. Eventually, landing as foreign minister for the Chavez government. Mm-hmm. And from there, he was when Chavez is ill. There is that famous news conference where you have Minister of the Interior Diosdado Cabello on one side and Maduro on the other side, and Chavez saying, "If I die, I would." Urge my followers to vote for Maduro. And he was then seen as the transition from Chavez to the new period after Chavez's death.
Mm-hmm. So how has his, I mean, he comes from a different background, Maduro, but he has, you know, deep experience in leftist and labor activism and politics. So
and also in Eastern religions. I mean, he goes to the and he's a follower of Saita Sai Baba. He traveled to India in 2005 with his wife and dabbled in Eastern religions. That's why he made this comment one time after Chavez that Chavez had appeared as hummingbird, and he talked to a hummingbird, and wow. that became a site of much ridicule. He hasn't repeated that since. But he inherits a Venezuela that's much different in 2013. Mm-hmm. As you point out, initially when Chavez is first elected, the U.S. is still undecided. Initially, you have under the Bush administration, you have the policies of Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell and others trying to inoculate Latin America from the cancer that was Venezuela.
Didn't they have Otto Reich working on that? Didn't they bring back Otto Reich?
They brought back Otto Reich.
The most appropriately named neocon.
All the folks that were involved in Central America are eventually recycled through the U.S. Department of State. And even under the Biden administration, we had others being recycled as well. Mm-hmm. So that he inherits a much different Venezuela, one that under Obama will be placed under sanctions. So that the same time that Obama's announcing a slight opening of relations with Cuba, he's announcing that Venezuela will be sanctioned because it represented a clear and present danger to the U.S. By 2013, 2014, there's already pressure on the now Maduro government. The opposition does not recognize his election. They claim it was illegitimate. The evidence points that he did win by a small margin, but he did win. And the 2014, he's already confronting an insurrection, La Salida, the exit, in which Corina Machado played a significant role along with Leopoldo López and others. So that the country is already clearly polarized, divided. The 2017 protest, further polarization. You begin to see food scarcities. You begin to see out-migration increase dramatically. Mm-hmm. The sanctions begin to take hold. It means that Venezuela is unable to purchase equipment to modernize its oil industry. It means that, again, the burdens of the crisis fall upon the majority of the population in the country. Mm-hmm. And he faces a much more difficult, much more polarized. But he also inherits a lot of the problems from Chavez. Mm-hmm. We have to look at that Chavez period with the same eye that we look at the Maduro period. Alliances with the church prevented them from making more positions on reproductive freedoms. Alliances with a emerging Bolivarian bourgeoisie made them pursue policies that benefited certain segments of the economy, certain segments of society. And that's eventually going to become part of that contradiction that we face later on. Part of the same issues in terms of corruption, not wanting to deal straight up with corruption. Every position, every president of the oil industry, every president of the Ministry of the Energy and Hydrocarbons has been tainted by corruption. And I'm not talking minor corruption. I'm talking millions. And sometimes, according to one report, Tariq El-Assami, the last person, was accused of billions of dollars in corruption. And there's no accounting for that. Instead, there is a circle the wagon mentality. We're under attack. We must circle the wagons, protect the party, or to become increasingly more authoritarian, particularly in dealing with contradictions that should not be raised to the level of oppression.
Right. So then there's elections in 2018, and these are more, these are, I don't know what would be the right way to put it. I mean, it's on all sides, it made it so that it's not really like a super democratic election, or it's not, I mean, the opposition, of course, is very extreme, unaccommodating, to put it mildly. Opposition, the U.S. is trying to squeeze really hard. So I guess one thing that you could say, although Maduro wins it, a big part of the opposition wants to boycott. I mean, the opposition is all about delegitimizing Chavismo and Maduro as well as Chavez. So right. That's their main goal. So it's hard to have a proper election when that is what the leadership's main goal is.
And that had been their mistake on many occasions. Yeah. In many occasions, they had opted not to run for office. I remember when they did not run for office and Chavez party then wins all the seats in the National yes. Assembly and is able to pass all the laws and all the super laws because they had a position of boycotting. They thought that by boycotting, they would delegitimate. If they would delegitimate, the system would collapse, and it didn't collapse. Yeah. In 2018, you had six, seven candidates running against Maduro. The main one was Henry Falcón from Avanzada right. Progresista. But the main opposition body opted not to run candidates, and in fact chastised the Henry Falcón and others for running against him. Yeah. When I thought that they had a good chance of actually winning because of the discontent in society was already increasing.
Right.
But their position, as you point out, was to delegitimate, not participate, and that would in fact allow the Maduro government to fall. It did not fall. This is also a time in which by 2019, you have Juan Guaido, you have Trump, mm-hmm. and you have Guaido declaring himself unilaterally the president, mm-hmm. then a campaign of maximum pressure.
What a farce that was.
Run by the White House that involved 60 countries, that involved trying to bring in food from Colombia, trying to create an incident at the border, having a concert with Latin American singers at the border.
Richard Branson.
Richard Branson was present as well. Yeah. But money being pumped into the opposition that has never been accounted for.
Yeah.
The opposition for some became a very lucrative endeavor. Mm-hmm. And the profits of the we've never had a full accounting of where those funds came from, where they were spent. But we do have people surviving in Madrid, in Bogota, mm-hmm. in the Dominican Republic, in Miami, and follow the money, we'll follow the trail.
So thanks to the sanctions and the economic warfare, I Venezuela's economy collapses some 70%. I think it's like the worst
peacetime collapse, yes.
Yeah.
Inflation was outrageous. We're talking about 1,000% inflation.
Right.
I have boxes of money that's useless.
Wow.
And most Venezuelans had boxes of money that was useless. Scarcity, poverty, those are the consequences that led to millions of people migrating and leaving the country. And that migration became, it was interesting how Maduro dealt with it. Initially, he ridiculed it. He ridiculed immigrants, saying that they wanted to go live in Miami and clean people's toilets. That expresses a complete disregard and misunderstanding for the reality that people were beginning to feel in the context of Venezuela, and was insulting to the Venezuelans who were migrating through the Darien Straits trying to find employment in the U.S. But then it's interesting how that diaspora functions in the U.S. because today the Trump administration is withdrawing the TPS from Venezuelans, and they're being deported back to Venezuela. Cubans are not being deported to Guantanamo, so that they're used as a political tool in to highlight the inequalities of the Maduro government. But then in the U.S., they're exploited by the Trump administration and deported back to the very country that that Trump claims is repressive.
Right. So in 2024, it looks like, based on even the reaction from the Chavez Maduro regime's friends, like in Mexico and AMLO in Brazil, that election really was a sham, unfortunately. That turnout was very low. That he did far more poorly, and the government did something unusual for the government, which was they didn't open the books the way they always had previously.
The tally sheets. The issue here became where the government did not release the tally sheets. They released the results of the election. They proclaimed Maduro a victor before the numbers had actually been fully counted, and unlike they had done in the past, they did not release the tally sheets. They claimed that the electoral system had been intervened by hackers from northern Macedonia. Mm-hmm. I don't know where they found them, but that they had been somehow interdicted the electoral results and the system had collapsed. But the winner was declared, and Maduro was declared the winner. There were protests in Caracas that were severely repressed, particularly protests in poor neighborhoods from mostly people of color that were repressed. Some political leaders were arrested. And the government withstood the protests and remained in power to this day.
So this brings me up to, I guess, a big question. As you said, Trump's threats and of direct kinetic, warfare, invasion, so on, these blustering threats are kind of, I would imagine, creating a bit of a rally, as they call it, a rally around the flag effect. I mean, it would in this country, for all the, 60% of this country doesn't like Trump. But if, China started putting warships around the country, I would imagine people would rally around even Trump. At least a portion of the people who hate Trump would. It's natural. So I'm wondering if the U.S., I have two questions. One is, how much support can Maduro count on if the U.S. actually goes in militarily versus how much support the opposition can count on? And then that will bring me to, and I'll try and wrap this up, questions about the Venezuelan military and paramilitaries.
Well, I think that you can, what you see in Venezuela is people who are critical of an intervention, who are opposed to a U.S. intervention, but they're also critical of Maduro. Right. Don't forget, there's also a left in Venezuela that's not Chavista, that supported Chavez, but doesn't support Maduro. So you have some of the most authoritarian actions on the part of Maduro have been against the left, intervening the Communist Party of Venezuela, intervening the Social Democratic Parties, intervening, and you have, in many ways, an effort to then distinguish themselves as the leftist when the reality is that they are attacking the left. And they've also because they are afraid of they understand that they're more vulnerable on the left than they are on the right. Mm. In that sense, I think that's the critical issue.
Of the left thinks that Maduro has betrayed the left.
They believe that Maduro has betrayed the working class. Mm. Wages have not gone up. Wages have been, in other words, the government to control inflation has essentially kept wages at a certain level.
Right.
And instead provide compensation through bonuses or through giveaways and boxes of food and other, they call them bonos in Venezuela, bonds. So that's the reality. So my point being that you can be opposed to Maduro and still be opposed to an intervention. Mm-hmm. The U.S. has done war games on Venezuela since the last two or three years. All of them turn out very badly. And they turn out badly because the military could fraction, and you could have the military taking over oil well producing areas. Yes. You could have the ELN, the guerrillas from Colombia on the western border taking over territory. You could have political parties factioning even, fracturing even further and claiming territory. You could see the disintegration of Venezuela.
Yes.
You could see another Caracazo in Venezuela where, again, you can't predict the outcomes. That's the real question. What happens the next day? Obviously, the U.S. has the military power to invade, but that invasion would be costly. Most assert that it would take 70,000 to 100,000 troops to actually control Venezuela, or to at least placate part of Venezuela, with no guarantee of how that may turn out long term. The U.S. may have to be present in Venezuela for quite some time. And I think that that's another factor in the Trump administration's decision-making about actual physical intervention. And that's why they're ratcheting up everything else from seizing boats to airspace to declaring an embargo, et cetera.
They're trying to foment a palace coup, it seems like. And I'm sure that, I mean, I've read some of the stories about like, for example, when they tried to bribe the defense minister, at least he claims so, probably true, during one of, I think, John Bolton's attempted coups. But it's not working. And so I'm just like, how is it that Maduro has the backing of the military elites? Like, what is this core backing there of people who would otherwise maybe overthrown?
Well, I think you're right. From September, the initial process begins in September with the bombing of the boats off the coast of Venezuela. And it's meant to see if there's any fissures or fractures within the Venezuelan military. But the Venezuelan military, after 2002, has been really integrated into the economy, into the politics. So this leadership is clearly vested in the continuation of the Maduro government or the Chavista government. They play a role in the economy. The military plays a role in the politics. And the language that Chavez used was a civilian-military alliance, a political alliance between the civilian sector and the military that would sustain in power and that would make Venezuela coup-proof. And that's why you haven't seen the military fracture. There may be dissidents within the military, but the cost of that dissidence would be very high because there's another faction within the military that is very pro-Chavista. And the military is afraid of fear. What it fears the most is a civil war in which they themselves are playing out the role. And that's been part of Chavez's strategy from the very beginning, and it's part of Maduro's strategy from the very beginning. And that's the greater role that the Secretary of Defense, Padrino, plays in society. And that's how you begin the process of trying to coup-proof your own government. So we have not seen the fissures that the U.S. expected, and that's why we see them ramping up and ramping up and ramping up. But who sold them on the fact that there would be fissures? That's the opposition. It reminds me of remember Ahmed Chalabi.
I was going to say Chalabi.
In Iraq, the person who promised them that they would be received with as liberators, that they would be flowers on the streets. Well, in Venezuela, they went one step further. Maria Elvira Salazar, the congresswoman from the Cuban American congresswoman in Florida, actually said that the Venezuelan women would be running up to the Marines trying to get married to them. That's how absurd the language became.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. And, you know, the funny thing is Trump came to power trashing, back in 2016, trashing the wing of the Republican Party that backed the Iraq War. And he kept claiming he was always against it.
Permanent conflict. And here we are back to permanent conflict. So that you have the national security document saying that they're against permanent conflict.
Yes.
The one that just came out last week. But the practice in Venezuela is the opposite. They're engaged in regime change. They're engaged in destabilizing a government. The price of oil is probably going to increase because it's the challenges to the oil market presented by what's happening in Venezuela now. I think they went up $2 a barrel yesterday. So the situation remains highly volatile.
My understanding is the armed forces have about 125,000 active personnel, but that the the national militia, the Milicia Campesina, or the Colectivas, it runs up between 1 million and 3 million strong. I don't know how serious that force is.
I don't think those numbers. They may be a bit high.
Okay.
They may be a bit high. I said the situation remains very volatile.
Right. Last question, and then I'm going to let you go. There's so much I want to talk about history. We didn't even get to 19th century, the Federal Wars. There's a lot that you'll get in the book, and I strongly recommend anyone interested in what's happening today in Venezuela to get the book. But my last question has to do with Venezuela's friends, and who basically based on what America forced them into, these kind of de facto alliances, like with Iran, Russia in particular, have the Iranians and Russians provided them with, useful and much sort of military hardware and know-how and so on? Like, how deep is that relationship, do we know?
Venezuela, under Chavez, began a south-south set of relationships. They promoted a multipolar world. Mm-hmm. They promoted new alliances, which included China, Russia, Iran, which included Brazil, Latin American countries. They've all expressed their support for Venezuela in the current crisis. Some may have provided them with military technology, the Chinese, the Russians, primarily. Mm-hmm. But again, I don't have the numbers and I don't have the actual details of what they actually provided. They have expressed their solidarity, but beyond that, I doubt that they will express anything else.
Right. Yeah, I saw Oliver Stunkel of Belfort saying that the U.S. has very limited intel in Venezuela and on Venezuela, so they're very reliant on these chalabis, as you talked about, and that also there's been a massive exodus of experienced U.S. diplomats, so there's even less.
That's critical because, when I was doing my research in the National Archives in Washington, I ran across three plans for the invasion of Venezuela. Three plans. They all focused on oil, and they all counted on the large American expat community that worked for the oil companies as their eyes and ears on the ground. And today they don't have that. They don't have that.
That's really interesting.
So that's an interesting tidbit.
All right. Well, I'm going to let you go because I kept you longer. It's such a fascinating talk, and I really recommend everyone by Miguel Tinkersalas' book, Venezuela, What Everyone Needs to Know.
And I also have another book called The Enduring Legacy, Oil Culture and Society in Venezuela, which will give you a much more history of what oil did to the in the country, socially, culturally, politically, and that helps explain some of the contradictions today as well.
Yeah, that's great. I'm going to read that one next because you do touch on that in your What Everyone Needs to Know book, but I'm sure there's a lot more depth to that in your other book. So I look forward to that. Thank you so much, Miguel Tinkersalas, for coming on Radio More Nerd.
Thank you very much.
Okay, I think we can end it here. Thank you again to our guest, Miguel Tinkersalas. Buy his book. I'm going to post links. Buy both of his books, actually. I'll post links to both of his books. And thank you again to everybody. Thank you, Brendan. And thanks to John, who is recovering fast and looking to have a good comeback in 2026. Although that wasn't the last you should hear from him this year. You will hear more from him. Thank you again, everyone. Talk to you soon. Bye.